I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Greg Opstad, Michael G. Smith, and Mary Strong Jackson. They are all poets who have contributed to the volume called Liberty's Vigil, the Occupy Anthology. It's 99 poets among the 99%, and they will be taking part in a reading called Occupy with Poetry tomorrow, Wednesday, the 22nd of February, from 6 to 8 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, that will be at the Lucky Bean Downtown Cafe in the Sambusco Shopping Center. So let's talk about this book. It's it's bound with string. It's a book of poetry from, I guess, all over the United States, published by Foothills Publishing. How did this come together?
There are two editors. The main editor, Carla Lynn Merrifield, who's a New York State poet, had the idea to do this last fall. And she contacted the second editor, Dwayne Wilder, and he agreed to help. They contacted Foothills, and Foothills agreed to publish it. Then they just spammed.
99% of the United States of America?
And international. There's international contributions in here, too. I think 8 countries.
I wish they'd put in where everybody was from. You read these poems and you don't know where anybody's from.
I think it's in the back.
The list of contributors is in the back, and sometimes it says where they're from. That depends on what the contributors wrote in their bios.
Oh, okay.
I think the call from submissions went out in different ways. I received it from the publisher because I've had some books published by Foothills Publishing. It's a little family-run publishing company in New York, and they hand-stitch the books themselves.
Yeah.
So that's very cool.
So they must be somewhat limited edition.
I think that they will keep making them as however many they need. You know, hopefully they'll sell a lot.
So there are poetry readings going on all over the country with the poets from this book reading. Are they all happening tomorrow? Is it like a simultaneous nationwide event?
No, it's been an ongoing. They've started as soon as the book was out, January 15th, and they're continuing, and they've just been in various places.
Would you like to, as a starting point, each read your contribution to this book?
Sure, that'd be nice.
Okay. Mary, do you want to start?
Sure. My poem comes from conversations with a homeless friend of mine, and it's called The New Homeless Rage. The world's gone pear-shaped. Do you feel it? How did I get here, you ask, in this 2 degrees and once business-owning life of mine? 2, maybe 3 missteps. Now I sleep in a state park, scared of snapping sticks, grim reapers, wolves, and werewolves. Afraid to sleep, afraid to wake. Always the cold. Coming, going, staying. But my shivery spine comes from eyes that glaze when I tell my story. Don't worry, you'll find a job, they say, pat, pat. What don't you fucking get, I say. I can't stop crying, swearing, raging. I know what it is to flip the light switch in a house, draw a bath, lie on Martha Stewart sheets, plant a lilac bush on Saturday, drink a latte on Sunday. It's gone. I am less. Homeless, moneyless, scared shitless. I tell the Tuesday soup kitchen lady thank you and ask what she does the other 6 days when the wolves are eating me. Does anyone get it?
And that's Mary Strong Jackson reading the poem from Liberty's Vigil, the Occupy Anthology. Now, this is a true story of a friend of yours, and it's probably the true story of a lot of people.
It is. I'm a social worker as well as a poet and a freelance writer, and I'm working with a lot of what the people that are really, I guess, getting to me are the women my age that come in to where I work, and they spend hours on the computer looking for work, and they're women that had successful careers and find themselves in this desperate situation. So it's kind of shocking to me. And so yes, this is exactly how she was feeling.
And it's it's interesting. First of all, it's an obvious example of the total lack of safety net that we have in this country that the woman in this poem and the others whom you meet literally don't have a place indoors to rest their head.
That's true. Some of them are in very desperate situations. Luckily, there are, I mean, we do have some homeless shelters here, or some a women's shelter, but that's also limited. You know, they can stay a few months, but then they have to move out because there's more that need to move in. So they have to really work to find another place to go.
And these people are looking for jobs the whole time.
They are. It's not like they're just sitting around waiting for something good to happen, because they are just desperately, frantically looking for work.
Let's hear your poem, Greg Opstad.
Okay. Saying goodbye to the middle class. Switch to basic cable. Don't go out to eat as often. Eat peanut butter, ramen noodles. No trips to the mall, no summer vacation. Cancel the paper, drop the cable altogether. Don't even go out to McDonald's in the next round of cuts. Jeans at Goodwill are $3.99 a pair, shoes $5. Go to the emergency room if the kids really get sick. Buy the cheapest tires, the ones without a mileage guarantee. New ones on the front, the better of the worn ones in back. Change the oil, but wait on the brakes. Walk to the laundromat when the washer quits. Juggle the bills, this one this month, that one the next. You said you'd never do it, but the stuff you still can't cut goes on the card. Even without a raise, you are glad to have a job. They talk layoffs, and you don't sleep at night.
Now, is this a story of a particular person?
I've been talking to and listening basically to my adult children. They're in their late 30s, early 40s, and just within my own family, I'm seeing people slowly lose the footing that they had. Their jobs are not, prices are going up, their jobs are not paying the bills as well as they did, and they're gradually slipping further and further behind.
It's such a perfect encapsulation of how even living without what some people call necessities, I mean, if you think of television as a necessity or a luxury, some people think it's a wonderful thing to do without, but it gets down to the brakes on your car, which are not a luxury.
Right.
And when that starts to go, it shows how society begins to fall apart. At some point, somebody who didn't fix their brakes because they couldn't has an accident, and the social fabric is torn.
Gradually, I'm just seeing more and more people making that slide. Both people I know, you know, personally, and, you know, stories you hear on the news. People are just falling behind and not able to live up to the dream that we were lucky enough to experience.
Michael G. Smith, would you like to read your poem?
Yeah, gladly. Just as a little background, I took my 6-year-old niece to one of the Occupy marches, and so the poem is written from her perspective, from the discussions we had during and afterwards. My school needs playground equipment. I am 6 and do not understand some of the signs people hold, but I do understand mic check and all these happy people who want to be heard. Even people driving by honking and waving want to be heard. They wave and smile as me and Maita hold our handmade sign. Less military dollars, more social dollars. Except one who waved his middle finger. I think he needs to play more, like I pretend standing on the street today is sort of a game. Even though Maita explained, some people are afraid and play expensive, dangerous games where many people get hurt or killed. and the sun is shining, and all these happy people are talking and waving, and Maita talks to this person and that person, then explains to me what they talked about. But I want the angry man to be happy and feel safe. But before I can ask if he will buy a chocolate bar to help my school get swings and a slide he could play on too, he drives away.
And that was Michael J. Smith from the Occupy anthology. Now, it's interesting, you also have written a poem based on the experience of somebody close to you, in this case, a child.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really pretty much your poetic transcription of her experience?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we talked quite a bit about how money gets spent in this country. One of my major concerns is the amount of money that is spent on so-called defense.
So-called defense.
Yeah, it's offense. It's not defense. And it's offensive. 50% of the discretionary federal budget goes towards defense, which is seven times the total amount spent by the rest of the world on defense. So the fact that, you know, we're spending all this and our children can't even get slides at their schools,
right.
Something's really out of balance. And and the way I see it is, you know, we could be taking a good chunk of this money and putting it towards education, energy sustainability, things like this, things that really make a difference.
This is such an interesting set of three poems that the three of you have read, because it speaks in a little microcosm, three little microcosms, of what society looks like when you have tremendous inequality. These are three examples of what it looks like, and they all have to do with the breakdown of the system and the inability of ordinary people to live ordinary, what we have constructed as ordinary lives, which in a country as rich as this, I think a lot of people think should be something that we can expect.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and it's going beyond, it includes other issues too, like healthcare, right? 50 million Americans approximately don't have health insurance. And
many more who do have inadequate health insurance and still go broke.
Right. And people put off going to the doctor until the problem becomes almost catastrophic.
Fixing your brakes, something bad is eventually going to happen.
Right. Even fire stations are closing and public schools are underfunded. It's, how can this be happening, you know? It's just almost unbelievable what is slowly, just like Greg said, just a gradual decline. You know, my coworkers were saying the other day, they're saving less. They keep having less and less money each year. You know, it's really frightening.
So what is the participation of each one of you in the Occupy movement above and beyond this poetry anthology?
I've only been to one of the Occupy Santa Fe happenings, and I'm not sure what my role is, but right now I know it's as a poet and bringing those truths and the images to light the best I can.
I haven't done anything directly, but my wife has gone to some of the Occupy Santa Fe events and feels very strongly about the lack of health care that's going on in the country and how things are just gradually falling apart, and we need to speak up. We can't remain invisible anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. With the whole Occupy movement, it's an amorphous movement that still somewhat trying to define itself. And I see my role in it as being a speaker, doing things like this, continually writing and talking to people.
How do you see in general the role of poetry in social movements?
I think poetry's always been a most important, just like any kind of art. You know, when we want to study a culture, we look at their art. And poetry cuts right to the truth, I think. I think it's the most honest form of communication. You know, it's not about being preachy or it's not about the poet. It's about bringing causes and people's lives to life. That's the way I see it.
I think all poetry is political. And poets are observers of the things that are going on around them. And they want to find the way to express the truth, express what they see in as clear a way as they're able to do that so that other people will pay attention and listen.
Yeah, and poets have been doing this for centuries. You know, in our lifetimes, poets have written quite a bit about the environment, environmental issues. After that, another example that I can think of is the Poets Against the War movement that started during the run-up to the Iraq-Afghanistan invasions in 2001, right? Yeah. And
03.
Yeah. And thousands and maybe 100,000 poems got submitted to the Poets Against the War website, and they were ultimately delivered to the White House. Not that
it did any good.
It did some good in some ways, but you know, poets need to continue to speak out on all of these issues.
So the event that's happening tomorrow at 6 o'clock at the Lucky Bean Downtown Cafe here in Santa Fe. What will be happening? The three of you and another poet, Jules Nyquist, will be reading. Will you also read some of the pieces that other poets around the world have written?
Yes, we will. And other people can also read. If other people would like to come, they can read from the book, other poets or anyone else. And there will be an open mic later, and they can read their own work also.
Excellent. What do you see as the potential or your hope for the Occupy movement?
Well, one, definitely to continue spreading the message of inequality, misgovernment spending, potentially. President Obama has clearly gotten the message. His new budget projects taking money away from the Pentagon and putting it towards sustainability, energy sustainability, education, research and development, and maybe jobs. So it's really clear that the movement needs to keep getting these messages out.
Yeah, continuing. Hopefully the Occupy will just keep growing and growing, and people will start to realize that we have power when we can work together. We do. I mean, just what we've seen with the internet and different things, we can spread the word quickly, and there's 99% of us, so.
Well, we look forward to seeing you tomorrow at the Lucky Bean Downtown Cafe, which is on the web at luckybeandowntowncafe.com, and it's in the Sambusco Shopping Center in Santa Fe. Greg Opstad, Michael G. Smith, and Mary Strong Jackson, thanks very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Shirley.